Monday, February 8, 1993. Louise Bodie speaks on the transcendent function and life's transitions. The transcendent function, according to Dr. C.G. Jung, is the process of a symbolic renewal growing out of the tension of opposites. All transitions of life embody this conflict of the opposites as we are moved from what is familiar to the unknown. But if the ego can bear the pressure of psychic conflict and not rush into a decision, the creative aspect of the self can respond. Over time, a renewal of meaning is attained that includes both opposites, yet transcends them. We experience this birth, or rebirth, or renewal of life. There are two aspects of the transcendent function, the response of the self that has been likened to the grace, since we don't know why it happens, and the ego, ambiguous, with longings and fear for change. But through conscious intent, the ego may prepare for its role in the process. The decision will focus, the discussion this evening will focus on the psychological mysteries of commitment, humor, trust, and attitude, and how they impact us as we confront the call of the self in major and minor transitions. Louise Bodie, Jungian analyst, lecturer, and teacher, has been in private practice in Chicago and Seattle for 18 years, founded the member of the Jungian Analysts North Pacific.
Arrangement, you'll probably just see me doing this all night long. But the other way, it seemed like sometimes I couldn't see the last half of the room or the last third. And so we'll try this time. What I want to do tonight is meander around a lot of material. The theme for the programs this year have been transition. And actually that's about life itself, isn't it? Because all of life is transitions. Some very big, some very little, but always change, always something going on. And so when I was invited to be one of your speakers, I was quite pleased, and I thought, yes, I'd love to talk about the transcendent function, because I think that is at the very heart of this thing that we're calling transition. It's at the very heart of change. And the transcendent function is at the heart of Jung's teaching, the heart of his thought, and we couple it with this phrase that we hear so often, holding the tension of the opposites. And it's right in the middle of his wonderful revolutionary concept when he first talked of it, that our psyches are self-regulating. And that's terrific if you stop and think about it a minute. It means that innately you and I come in a way that our psyche regulates and keeps us in balance, that we come in with the possibility of good mental health, of happiness, and the psyche regulates and balances just like our body. But when Jung said that was very revolutionary. So tonight, the transcendent function, and I'm going to, as I say, meander through some material. The more that I worked with this subject, the more I found. And what I'd like to do is talk about 40 minutes. We may not be able to go that long. You're close together. I think it's warm in here now. How many think it's warm? A few in the back. Okay, Kate, if you'll watch the windows, we'll... And then we'll take a break. We'll see how far we get with the material, and then we'll come back and finish it or not finish it and have some discussion. I keep moving this back because this gives me a wider scope of you. It's not that I'm trying to get away from you. And the three things that I want to do tonight in meandering through all this material is to first say, what is this transcendent function? Get a very workable definition. And then, what is it necessary to be there for this function to be set into operation. In other words, what is necessary for the transcendent function? And finally, what is our conscious or ego directed part in this process? And if you can only remember those three things, you'll have the skeleton of what I'm talking about. I'm going to put a few things up here on a piece of paper. It's for those of you who maybe like me just need the visible signposts, but if you can't see it, you haven't missed a thing. And it's not to take notes, because I'll be telling you about it. First off, there's nothing mysterious or metaphysical about the term transcendent function. And the basic definition of transcendent function, right from Jung himself, is that it's a psychological function which arises from the union of conscious and unconscious contents. And that's about as simple as you can get. A psychological function which arises from the union of conscious and unconscious contents. Now, we know that the conscious and unconscious seldom agree in their contents or in their tendencies. They are either compensatory or complementary. And the conscious, of course, is what we are aware of. And you know that the unconscious are those things that we've either forgotten or repressed. And also in the collective unconscious contains traces of the memories and behaviors of really our whole human race. But it's the tendencies of these two together, conscious and unconscious, that make up the transcendent function. And it's called transcendent because it makes the transition from one attitude to another. And does this organically, so that what comes up from the unconscious doesn't get lost. And you've all experienced this in your dreams. You've had a dream where you awakened from it and there was an image and a feeling that you were very much in touch with. And something completely different than you'd known when you went to sleep came into consciousness and it was there with you. It was the material from the unconscious. And so the transcendent function, this word transcendent, doesn't mean being above it all. In fact, the etymology of the word is to climb across. And that's exactly what it means here. It's kind of a bridge. It's not vertical. It's not ethereal. It's not up in the clouds. And imagine, if you can, your physical body stretched across a chasm. And there was something on this side and something on this side. And there you were, stretched between. It would put a tension on you, wouldn't it? And stress would arise. Well, when we hold the tension of the conscious and the unconscious that comes into our thinking, when we just sit with it, we're in that same position, and stress arises, energy accumulates. And it's that energy which then finally breaks through and thrusts us up into a creative and a new place. And so that's then the basic notion of the transcendent function. And it's out of that stress that there comes some kind of a symbolic direction, a new creative act or an attitude. And in all my reading, I don't think that I've found a more beautiful description and maybe amplification of this than what Ladson Hinton wrote in a paper. Gee, this was some 20 years ago, when he wrote a paper on humor and the transcendent function as it was at work in that situation of humor. And I just want to read you several paragraphs of this. Excuse me. All right, I'm quoting from Ladson. The transcendent function, according to Jung, is the process of symbolic renewal growing out of the tension of opposites. If the ego is able to actively participate in both sides of a psychic conflict without resolving, in quotes, that conflict, by too soon identifying with one side or the other, the conflict becomes intensified and highly charged with energy. And eventually, the conscious will become paralyzed, since there's no rational way out of the tension. And put yourself into a situation as I read this, so that you really get the feel of what a transcendent function is at work. A situation that has no way out. And since there is no rational way out of the tension, you simply can't think of a way. You can't feel of a way. Both sides of the polarity have their rightful place in psychological life, even though they are logically incompatible. Now, all the energy which is constellated by that conflict is dammed up. And it flows backwards, so to speak, into the unconscious depths. And here, the creative aspect of the self responds with threads or avalanches of new symbolic meanings. And over a shorter or a longer time, a new level of meaning is attained, which includes both of these opposites, both sides of the conflict, and yet transcends them. The process in question is a psychological one that unconsciously repeats itself almost continually, although we are conscious of it only when it swings into the extreme. And here's a lovely sentence. He says this: thus, the life of the soul is continually created out of the tension of the opposites. This creative activity of the self becomes visible to consciousness as the transcendent function in the more dramatic, prolonged, and increased conflicts. I think you all know what Ladson was talking about. Our souls are stretched and tried as we come out of these periods of conflict, when we hang in there and the opposites are somehow held together and something new emerges. And so that then is what we're talking about when we say the transcendent function. Now, I think that's pretty clear. How many of you have experienced such a situation? All right, we don't need to belabor this. So we know what it is, don't we? Now, what is necessary for this to happen? Remember, we have unconscious and conscious material. And of course, first, we need that unconscious material. When Jung came forth with this idea so many years ago, the unconscious was not as available to people as it is now. And now we know all kinds of ways. We have all kinds of access to our unconscious material through dreams, art, theater, poetry, music, movement, even to play. And all that was available then, but by the majority, it wasn't looked at in the way that it is now. In so much of life, we see things more symbolically. We see the double meanings in events. We see the symbolic. Just like, remember the vivid colors that started to appear after the counterculture's trip with LSD? Before that, we had red, green, yellow, black, blue, and then we had, wow, lime and cherry, phosphorescent and purple. So something new emerged. And we have to have the unconscious material. And second, we need the directedness of the conscious. And I can't underline this too strongly. In his work called Structure and Dynamics of the Psyche, Jung emphasized over and over that it is not enough to simply have an idea. It's not enough that the symbol come in a big dream that absolutely touches us so deeply that we can't even talk about it. What comes from the unconscious, the feelings, the symbol, whatever, it has to be integrated in a meaningful, authentic, and practical way. If you remember, Jung gave a marvelous example of this about one of his clients who came in with a dream to him. The client was a young male, loved to do mountain climbing. And he came in with the dream to Jung that he had been out mountain climbing and that he stepped off in space. And what did Jung caution him? Do you remember? He said, be careful when you go climbing. Perhaps you shouldn't even climb. And a few weeks later, when the young man was out mountain climbing, he did indeed step off into space and was killed. So when we don't integrate what comes up from the unconscious, it may not be as catastrophic as that, but it will have its consequences. And I think that there are three things that absolutely will happen, one or the other of these. If we integrate what comes up, if we mull it around and make sense, so that there can be the union of these two things, then, as in the case of the young mountain climber, he either would not have gone climbing or he would have taken extra care. He would have put that right into his everyday life. The second thing that happens when we don't integrate what the unconscious allows us and gives to us is kind of that medium place in between the inner and the outer world. When we sink into a depression, there's nothing but inertia. We can call it stagnation if you take it to the ultimate. We've gotten the message and we don't use our ego strengths to do anything about it. And finally, of course, it will go back into the unconscious, or this is a third option, that if we don't integrate it. And what happens when that energy, having come up and is rejected or not listened to, and it goes back, then it's stronger than ever in the unconscious. And probably then that's when something is acted out, like the young man who was mountain climbing. So to know and to not act, that has been condemned through the ages, hasn't it? Once we know, then we must act. And I don't mean we have to know the solution, but we have to work at it. We have to carry it around. We have to honor what it is that the unconscious gives us in intuitions, in dreams, in feelings. And in Jung's day, as I've said, the unconscious material was not recognized so quickly as such, and there was not easy access to it. Sometimes now I think that among at least a certain proportion of the population who have learned and who do know, it's the directedness of the conscious side that needs the help, needs the push. And I wrote in the little squib for the newsletter. Those were some of the things that we would be considering tonight. So we've said what the transcendent function is. We've said what it is necessary for it to be with us, what materials to have. And I think that there are three arenas, or we might call them three vessels, where the transcendent function is at work. And I'm talking here now, expanding out from these specific things of dreams and art. And I think one is those things that happen, we might call them acts of God, or we might call them the natural vessel where transition happens, or where the transcendent function is at work. The second one would be the vessel that the collective has built over eons of time. And finally, are the personal vessels that we build or that we have a hand in making. And in these situations, the transcendent function can operate. And so briefly, I just want to look first at what I've called the natural vessel. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this. I really want to focus on what the collective has done and primarily then what the individual does. But in the natural vessel, I think those big moments of life, and I wrote down just five of them that seem to come in chronological order. And first, there's birth and rebirth. There's the birth of our own children and the changes that come in raising them and then letting them go, and coming to grips then with the issue of our own rebirth. And so that would be the first one that I would call a natural container. The second would be love and sex. We discover our own sexuality. And then as we mature, there come the issues of relationship and of commitment, and even more than commitment, of fidelity. And so how do we balance these two powerful opposites? They're not opposites, they go together. I shouldn't have called them opposites. But there's a gradation of something here. So how do we balance love and sex? And that's another of the natural vessels or arenas where the transcendent function is at work. And third, creativity and stagnation. As we mature, the world isn't brand new anymore. Our experiences are new. But before long, we begin to repeat things. And the repetition can either be just repetition, or out of the experience, it doesn't have to be repetition, it can be creativity. So we don't have to stagnate when life isn't brand new. We can be creative. But how do we renew these creative energies? How do we get to them? And in our own, the fourth would be sickness and health. In our own illnesses or those we love, the very real fragility of physical form, of our physical life, becomes very real. And so how is it that we let sickness teach us? And how do we accept what we can't escape? And parallel to that, how do we enjoy and be free and be open with health? So sickness and health. And then finally, sorrow and loss. Finally, through life, loss accumulates and change takes place. Illness, aging, death of our loved ones, and the awareness of our own death. Change may take a job from us, may take financial security, or it may take a home. And so how do we come to grips, how do we come to terms with these unavoidable losses and sorrow of life? And I think all of these are vessels that the transcendent function works in when we're trying to balance two opposites. Now, we could take any one of these, and I could ask any one of you, and you could come up with examples. I'll just give you an example from my own life quickly, the transcendent function was working through dreams. And each of these are dreams that came after the death of my parents. Perhaps some of you have heard me tell the one after the death of my mother. But after the death of my father, perhaps it was 2 or 3 months, I can't quite remember, and I was in the old home in the dream in our old farmhouse, and I was looking out the north window. And out as far as I could see across the fields, the land was rippling, just like it was undulating, like a tidal wave, except it wasn't like a tidal wave, it was like the big swells on the sea. And this came right up against the north side of the house and stopped. And of course, I was amazed, just absolutely amazed. And my father had been sitting in a porch swing on the south side of the house. So I ran to say, "Did you see that?" And of course, my father was gone. But out of that dream came a deep knowledge. Yes, my father was gone. What a powerful thing is death. But I was there, and I was coping. And from then on, the grieving was very different. And the same thing after the death of my mother. Living in Kansas, where tornadoes occasionally came, we had a place in the cellar, and it was the rule that you always got in the southwest corner because the storms came from the southwest. And if it blew the house, it would blow it away. It wouldn't dump it on you if you got in the northeast corner. Too bad. So in this dream, Mother and I had gone down into the cellar. There was a fierce wind like we had never, ever heard before. And it was blowing and it was shaking the house. And I got into the southwest corner as I had been taught. And I wasn't sure where Mother was in the dream. But all at once she was there and she said, "I think I'll go and see if it's gone." So she went out the cellar door. And by that time the wind had stopped. So I thought, "I'll go look too." And of course, I went out and Mother was gone. And this was another gift from the psyche of balancing, giving me information, beautiful feeling information that I had not had access to in the conscious world before. And there too, after that, the grieving process took a different turn. Because one is brought in touch with these, I suppose we could say archetypal truths, the self. But they come in such a way that they touch us in our very own experience. They speak to us in our very own time of what it is that we need to hear. And so you have had these experiences. And these are what I call the natural vessels, the natural containers. Often this comes without any of our initiating, and it's up to us just to hear. Now I want to switch to the collective vessel. And there are many of these, but I want to focus, because of time, just on the two that I feel are probably the most structured, or the most, just the most. One, the first, is religion. And it's been around literally since time began, since mankind walked and fell down and worshiped the sun after the long, hard winter. And I'm not talking here now about institutionalized dogma. I'm talking about I'm going to call it religion, because if you look that up in the dictionary and slide off all that's been stacked and gathered around it, it's simply a relationship with the highest and most powerful value. So that's what we're talking about when we're talking about religion. The other one that I want to talk about hasn't been around very long, and as I'm going to talk about it, it's really only probably been here 50 or 75 years, and that is the arena, the vessel of psychological help, of therapy. And as we follow through these two, I think we're going to find common threads where they weave in and out. But these are such potent and such helpful collective vessels that have been established. So I want to put up the first of one of these. Kate, would you like to put this up? And again, if you can't see this, I'll be reading it. I think I've undone my... Wait a minute, we need the metaphors. There. since the beginning of time. And it's been talked about. I'll turn this so each of you get a shot at it. It's been talked about in many, many ways through the ages. And there's a wonderful book. I hesitate to tell you because it's out of print. If you know somebody and you can Xerox a copy, it's Ralph Metzger's book, Opening to Inner Light. And he surveyed and worked with so much of the sacred literature that's come from through the ages. And he's come up with 10 key metaphors of how people through the ages have struggled or found ways to talk about this experience, where again, the unconscious and the conscious material were coming together. And the transcendent function in its creative way then was able to put them up a level. These will be familiar to many of you, but I'm going to briefly read the list. And remember now that a metaphor is talking about what something is like. A metaphor is not it. We stumble on words, but we have to have them. And so the first of these metaphors is awakening from the dream of reality. We particularly find this in Eastern cultures. We find this in many places. We find it in Gurdjieff's work. But awakening from the dream of reality. And we find that what we thought was reality, that's not reality at all. And when what we think is reality again, it changes. The second one is uncovering the veils of illusion. You begin to see how these feed back and forth and how they play with each other. And yet, the tales and the literature always are talking about these. From captivity to liberation. We've heard that we have to wake up, that we're captive. We've heard that the body holds us. And then we've come to learn that the body actually holds experiences that give us who we are. So we, whatever it is that's held us captive, we're liberated. There's the purification by inner fire. This particularly in the Kundalini tradition, in the tantric, in other ways, other traditions. From darkness to light, how often have you heard of enlightenment? What does that mean? We're going to have a lot of time for discussion so that we can get into whatever part of this interests you. From fragmentation to wholeness. And how often do we reiterate these metaphors in our own life? I was shattered. I was broken. I'm in the dark. Nothing's real anymore. And then there's the journey to the place of vision and power. This shows up so much in the myths. Remember Gilgamesh. It shows up in the bardos of the Tibetan Book of the Dead. And always, if we can remember that the myth, while it's talking about what's out there, it's simply a reflection of what's in here. And that brings these two things together. Then returning to the source, going home, whether that's just a small piece of going home, or whether people that reach, as Jung talked about it, the second half of life begin to think of going literally to the next place. And then on dying and being reborn, you know that whatever form it takes is the most radical, total transformation that anyone can undergo. It's life and death, it's eros and thanatos. And then finally, unfolding the tree of our life. And that's such a wonderful metaphor. Kind of takes all of these in. And you know the tree, the world tree, and you know that marvelous tree that has its roots up in the upper regions and blooms here, but its reflection, it blooming here and its roots go down. Now, these are ways that religion through the centuries has tried to talk about this process of the transcendent function at work. I want you to see the scope of this when I talk about religion through the ages. And Kate, you want to hang up another piece? You just leave that there and put this over it. What? Takes place in this vessel is primarily in four traditions. It's not in institutionalized dogma or running through empty form, but it's in the esoteric tradition. It's in the shamanistic tradition, in the hermetic tradition, and what's my other one there? Yes, and that would take all of the kinds of yoga. And yoga, by the way, is not, as you know, just physical exercise. Yoga is a way, and there are, interestingly enough, kinds of yoga for every type. And see, we think we've discovered something new with typology. And you go back to the old Hindu teachings, and there were at least four or five kinds of yoga. There was the bhakti yoga for the devotional, the feeling kind, I like to think. There was hatha yoga for the physical, the sensation-oriented. There was karmic yoga for those that needed to work something out. There was the jnanic yoga for the thinkers. If you've ever read some of Houston Smith's work, he has a wonderful little essay where he's talking about how we each have to find our own particular vocabulary, our own particular way. And he's talking how different the religious experience of the thinker is, how different from that of the feeling. And he's only speaking for himself. But he's talking about he is a thinking type person. And as he reads and as he writes, and some of you know this, he's right there with the muse. And it's very different, probably, than what the feeling and the devotional yoga would be. But he says the jnanic yoga. And so we're talking here about these four ways, esoteric, different than exoteric, which is out there, the hermetic, which is sealed like in alchemy, the yogic with its kind for each one. And where do we find that from the time beginning? And this was just to enhance our thinking and throw something out there. Whether it's Native American, Buddhist, the Sufis, the Gnostics, whether it's Christian, Islamic, Confucianism, and I didn't get that one on the chart, or the Taoist, whether it's the Judaic, the Judaism, not the Judaic Christian, but the plain Jewish, the Hindu, the Tibetan Buddhist, the Zen, whether it's alchemy, or even if it gets into parts of the occult, we're talking about a vessel that through the ages has had its practices, its rituals, where the conscious side of an individual made a conscious effort through practices, through ritual, and through listening to teachings to be accessible to what those teachings and what those experiences brought in from the unconscious. Those of you that are familiar with the Tibetan Book of the Dead know about this particularly. And there's a beautiful new book by Soygyal Rinpoche, some of you may have it, called The Tibetan Way of Living and Dying. And he really brings into our time and our culture what the teachings about living and what we can learn about death fit into our time. And you remember this book, oh gee, it's only been in Western culture now since probably 50 years. Evans Wentz brought it home from the East, and Jung wrote a magnificent introduction to it and explained a bit, because it was something that none of us had ever thought about. And I think it was Houston Smith or else Lama Govinda who said, you know, Westerners have spent years and years, centuries, developing the scientific mind, and they know things, and they know how to put somebody on the moon. Well, the Eastern teachers have spent years and centuries exploring and developing the inner world. And out of their experience, they know what happens after death. And ironically or synchronistically, much of our own Western scientific trained people are verifying many of what the Eastern teachers have already told us. So when I talk about this being a vessel for the unconscious to be brought into our conscious world, I think you all know what I'm talking about. Jung writes so beautifully of this in one of his collected works on the transformation in the mass, or of what happens. And we can take any one of these and find that wonderful, unique happening that's going on. So this is a vessel that the collective has, I don't want to say made, it's evolved, hasn't it? And it's almost organic, what we're talking about. Now the second collective vessel that I'll talk on just briefly is that of therapy. And I have two charts I want to... Let's first just put out there a bit of the scope of this field. It's this one, Kate. This one right here. From Ken Wilber's book, Spectrum of Consciousness. And when he wrote his first book, how many of you are familiar with Ken Wilber's work? Okay. The first time that he began to chart and began to put some of this together was in about 1979. And he listed some of the therapies. And I know you can't read this. It's too small written. But I'll run through it for you. He had a list, and as I went back and compared that with what we have now, it's amazing how the field of therapy has mushroomed. And so what do you see at work there? Why are there so many kinds of therapy now? Anybody?
Because people are...
Wait a minute. Here and then here. All right. Can you take it a little farther? So many kinds of people... That's right. Instead of saying levels, would you different piece of the pie? Yeah, because we don't want to get this on a ladder. And I really understand you, but it's right, B. And it is development. So different therapies search. Yes.
I like the word state.
State. That's good. I've never heard that. Yes, a different state. Mm-hmm. Well, the more that we discover about how many more states there are in us, we find therapies that focus on them, don't they? And again, it's to get to what we don't know. It's the only reason for therapy. And some of it may be very superficial things. We don't know why we fight or love somebody. Or very, very deep, we don't know why this archetype is doing what it's doing to us. What is triggering it? What's it connected in with? So some of these kinds of therapies, we start simple counseling, supportive therapies. Then there's psychoanalysis, psychodrama, transsexual analysis. How long since you've heard that one? So this dates, this is about 1979. There's reality therapy, there's ego therapy. Then there are all these writers, And my, how we go for them. Remember when Lang's came out, and he's still around with all the frames? There's Kohut, there's object relations, and I'm not demeaning any of these. Each one is absolutely terrific. And each one helps us to focus on that part where our hitch is. There's the 12th work that begins to put the talking therapy and the body work together. There's Rosen work. There's Reiki. There's all the work that Lowen did, Rolfing, polarity therapy, Traeger, Rosen work. There's movement therapy, art therapy, sand play, music therapy. And so you see how this has proliferated, all almost in an organic way to create a vessel where this transcendent function can begin to let these, to put us into a new place as these two things come together. Then we go on, and we're moving a bit deeper here, and I'm going to put up another piece of paper to show you. We go to Jung's analytical psychology. This is something different. We go to psychosynthesis, and that's with Prokhorov. We go to Maslow's work and the peak experiences. We come to the body-mind relationship. Interesting, Bill Moyers and his work starts on television in a week or so. And you know who, I think it's the 21st, I think. Does anybody know the date of Bill Moyers' work? 22nd, all right. Healing, the mind and healing. I'm not sure the exact title. But all his exploration in this body and mind connection. And you know, there's somebody that did something on this so long ago, and we forget all about it, and he never gets much credit. And who do you suppose that was? It was Jung. Do you remember that Carl Jung really developed the association test? Do you know what it is? How many know what the association test is? Word association. What does it do? How does it work? It aggravates the complexes. And how does it do that? Very simple. What, do you know how it's done? I remember when I was in training in Zurich and we paired off to give each other this test. And I was paired off with a wonderful woman that had trained to be a doctor. And she got clear through almost to the last set of exams. And for whatever dumb reason, which seems dumb to me now, she had to make a choice whether she would take that last 6 months and finish med school or whether she would marry. Seems to me she could have done both, but she didn't. And of course she got married. Well, any word on the association test that I would call out, and there are a list of words that had to do with nursing, medical, blood, whatever. Whew, there it was. And you do this, you use a little stopwatch, and you measure what's called a perseveration, how long it takes you to answer or to respond to the word. Well, this body-mind connection has been around a long time. And as you know, it was Jung's work on this test that then really led to the development of what we call the lie detector test. But all of this is on a certain state. Then we go to transpersonal psychology. And this, I think, is the borderland, which, if we go through, can bring us back almost in a circle to where we begin to get in some of the areas that we get into in religion. Now, I don't want to get into this too deep, but I'm only bringing this because I want you to see the vessel. I want you to see the arena. It's everywhere where the transcendent function works. And I think that it's 8:30. Why don't we take a break, Kate, And then I'll put up people during the break, and one in particular I would like to thank for saying that, you know, where does philosophy fit in here as a vessel? It's one of the key ones, and I suppose that religion, philosophy, and therapy, they're of equal value. Again, time limit-wise, I couldn't get to all of them. But thank you. We don't want to act like this is it. I'm going to skim real quick here on this goes with the therapy part. And I'm going to come up here and I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this, but I think also during the break someone said, how did you group those therapies? And really, we could group them by the different states that, let's just say the different states. And this again from Ken Wilber, and it's a marvelous book, The Spectrum of Consciousness. Do any of you know this? Good. He endeavors to take our life's activity and in talking about how we develop and where therapy fits. And he has drawn it to where this would be the conscious side and this would be the unconscious side. And so we see that in each of these areas, you know what shadow is, that's the repressed and unlived out and unknown part of us, according to Jung. There's the ego state. And many of those therapies deal primarily with ego issues, childhood, problem solving. Now, we can't make hard and fast statements. These all interlap. But some have as their focus. And ego state and the therapies that deal with that are very different than real analysis. Although we use a lot of working with ego and childhood issues sometimes in analysis because they come up in dreams. This, I think, is very interesting because the biosocial level, he's talking about what impacts us. And this comes in through our inheritance and through our culture, what we are taught, and it much of this is unconscious. Our prejudices, our belief systems, they funnel in. And remember, this is the unconscious side. Then we move along, we come to the existential. And here we get into what is organic and what really is environmental. Existential. What we experience in our bodies, in our psyches in a way that's very, I don't know what other word to use than existential. And the therapies that deal with this, there is an existential therapy some of you are familiar with, the logotherapy. And it's different than the ego therapy. And then we are moving on to where we come and we cross over what is transpersonal. And here is where we begin to have access in a very direct way with the unconscious material, with archetypal material. We get into transpersonal psychology that we begin to deal with those factors that come in from philosophy and religion. And also we might add to those two what comes in through literature, poetry. We could expand that. And then, of course, Jung's psychology goes both this way and into the existential, doesn't, or into the transpersonal, doesn't it? Now, after this area, we're really moving toward the part of the very esoteric religious disciplines when we get to what mind is And we can't do anything with this tonight. That would be a wonderful session if we could just spend 3 hours. But we particularly get into that in the Hindu, in the Tibetan Buddhism, into the kinds of meditation where the whole ego state really drops off. But we're in a whole different field there. The Buddhists deal a lot with that. Those of you that have read Trungpa's books or material that comes out of Naropa Institute in California, and they talk about Buddhist psychology. And yet it bridges, and it bridges into these areas, and eventually then what we're referring to here as mind is what Eastern thought calls the void. And it's not empty, is it? It's not some big hole, but it's that space that's so filled with the potential creative factors. In a way, it may be the realm of Jung's archetypes. I mean the archetypes, not the archetypal images. Once you get an archetypal image, something's already into consciousness. We're talking about deep, deep, but the void with a capital V, where all of that mixed up, creative, undifferentiated potential is. So the therapies would be grouped around these areas, and of course they overlap. This is entirely too fast, but this is this vessel of religion that the collective has helped to organically evolve and maintains. Now I want to go to the final one, which is the personal one. We might as well put up that other piece of paper, Kate. One of these vessels is the personal, and I've tried to represent the circle. I don't know, it's our life, it's how these things interact, and the arrows go both ways and they flow back and forth. But again, here there are many vessels that we personally can help evolve. And because of time, I've only chosen two that I'm going to touch on very, very briefly. One is humor. Through the ages, we've loved people that have a sense of humor. And the Native Americans had Coyote, the trickster. He carried that role for them, didn't he? Literally pull the rug out from under people. Well, a mixed metaphor, but... And people laughed, you know, and there was the court jester. So through the ages, this has been... we've known about this. And how do we get humor operative in our own life so that through that means we cooperate with the unconscious that gives us little hints of what's going on? How many of you are familiar with this book that's just running wonderfully rampant all over? And by saying that, you probably know what I mean. The Women Who Run with the Wolves. I think Clarissa Estes does such a wonderful piece in talking about humor in one section. And I have to... let me do it this way. Just be aware of yourselves the way you are now. And I want to tell you one of my favorite jokes from this part of the book where Clarissa is talking about humor and about the wonder of the instinctual humor and body humor. So now... just be where you are. Be aware of what you are. Do you remember the story? It was in World War II days. And there had been a great victory. And one of the islands down in the South Pacific had been taken and returned to American forces. And the commanding general was going to come into the town to revel in the victory and to see everyone. So his aides made contact with the native leaders, And they were cautioned and warned over and over. Now look, the day that the general comes to town, the women must cover their tops. Well, the aides thought, do they get the message? And the village people thought, well, if they say so. So they assured him, yes, indeed, the women would cover their tops. So the day of the big parade came, and the commanding general was coming into town, and here came the jeeps and flags and the trumpets, and the little dirt roads were lined with the village men and women. And as the general's car came near, the women bowed and deftly lifted their skirts. What happened? That's what humor is about, isn't it? Yeah. And you remember old Nasruddin? Remember those wonderful Sufi stories? We heard so many of them in the late 60s and early 70s. And Nasruddin was this funny old fellow that sometimes he was so wise and most of the time he was so dumb. And one night he was out looking for something, and a friend came by and said, Nasruddin, what are you doing? And he said, oh, I lost my key in the backyard. And the friend said, well, then what are you doing around here looking for it? And Nasruddin said, well, here's where the light is. I can find it. You know, it's when we can see the Nasruddin in ourselves. And when we can see the real absurdity of the clash of cultures and see how absurd the clash in the South Seas was, and then we can laugh. There's the transcendent function. And we feel joy and something has been brought together, it's whole. And we can work on that. We're always, not always, but we tell people to lighten up. And we simply mean balance. Let it get in balance. The other thing is commitment. And what about the transitions that one doesn't choose? Actually, a lot of transitions are that way, aren't they? And as I noted before, Jung was very quick to emphasize that it's not a matter of simply having the ideas or the symbol that comes in that dream or even a powerful synchronicity or an insight, but we have to somehow get this integrated. The consciousness has to direct its efforts. This is one of the mysteries of life. It's one of the mysteries that happens as we're talking about or comes up as we consider this transcendent function. And so often as people work on themselves, they can identify the complex, their problem. They draw pictures about it. They talk to it. Some call it by name. But often it chatters in our heads and it puts us down or it feeds us that other material. And what do? We identify it. We call it the dark one or the ugly one or the left out one or the hurt one. And I think that if our consciousness can direct itself to the other aspects that are in us, you know, there's always been a faithful one in us that keeps us moving, keeps us making effort. Fairy tales talk about this as being on one's thread. And we could speak of this in different ways. And so when the dark one starts talking, if we can go back to some of those metaphors of waking up or stripping away illusion, and if we can confront the dark one, and talk to it and put our emphasis and our efforts so that what is unconscious can get through to us, so that our conscious effort can balance this up. Or, you know, the other opposite of this is simply to ignore it. When the dark one, the one that starts chattering, and you've all known this mind talk that just never quits, it seems, how do you confront it? And sometimes confrontation is the only way. Sometimes better to change the subject, to go for a walk, to do something different. Pests go away when they're ignored, don't they? Now, I think that this brings us really to the final little question that we may want to really get into our discussion, because I'm going to quit here in about 5 minutes. But there's a final question. Why then does the transcendent function not work sometimes? Even though we have the unconscious material, sometimes we have a conscious directedness and we're working on it. Well, first, I believe that this process does work. The effect or the effort may be so minuscule that we're not aware of what's happening. But you know, Jung said that even if you don't understand the meaning of your dreams, just the fact that you dreamed helps. And particularly it helps if you honor the dream and write it down and carry it around with you. And so little by little, we stretch ourselves across that chasm. We begin to make the bridge. In extreme cases, people do struggle so hard. And there's some, I think, where the ego is either so afraid or so hurt or so angry that it can't direct conscious energy. And I think that all of that ultimately goes back to fear. I really believe that all anger, all hatred, all stubbornness, at the bottom line is fear. And what's the little ego afraid of? Either it was so hurt that it didn't get strong enough to say back off, or it was so damaged that sometimes it couldn't bear, and so a part of it really splits off, and we have the mentally ill or the schizophrenic, who then in other ways is there. But at the bottom, the ego, the fear of being swallowed up. You know, Jung talks about the confrontation or the meeting with the self, and it's awesome. And the ego, to do that, has to allow itself to be given up. In all of these metaphors, in all of therapy, there are two things at work. One is the change and the sacrifice that brings change. And I'm using sacrifice advisedly, but it has to be there. The sacrifice of old attitudes, old behaviors, old ego stances. And that's where we really get into it, when the ego is afraid to do that, afraid it's going to be swallowed up. But I said that I believe this does go on. You've seen films of the physically handicapped skiing and the glory that was in them. Or you've seen the light in a retarded child's eyes when it did something that it didn't know it could do. And so what is success anyhow? And why does it seem to work sometimes and not other times? Is it our heredity? Is it the genes that we come in with? We could ask, is it karma? And open up another whole big area. What does that mean? What are our archetypal memories of racial behavior and of our own treatment? So what or why does it work sometimes and sometimes it doesn't? And I want to open now for discussion either on this or any questions that you have. And I think probably we go to 20 after. Is that too long, Kate, if there are questions or comments about any of this? We've gone terribly fast. But what would you like to say? Yes.
On one of your previous charts, you have Yogi and three other philosophies. You have Christianity and philosophy. You're retrying to draw a distinction?
No. I'm saying that there are four main ways that this works out: esoteric and yogic and hermetic, and what was the
shamanistic.
And that in Christianity there is the esoteric, there's the hidden. In the Native American Indian there might be the shamanic.
There are developmental limitations to the transcendent function. In other words, is it active in a young child, or is there a certain developmental process that has to occur before it starts to work? In terms of child dreaming and being able to bring that conscious material to the conscious mind and make those links.
This gets hard, and some of you probably know more about child psychology than I do. I think Jung technically was referring to the transcendent function as he saw it at work in his analytic work. But I think if we'll go with the whole scheme of what I've been working on tonight, this broad spectrum, yes, indeed, there does come a time in a child when it is conscious and it's able to put two things together. It's amazing what children know and what they say. Boy, you talk about transcendent function. And it may not know exactly as we can objectively stand off and see it at work, but you've seen children put two things together and come up with something.
That seems to have a transcendent works with us. It comes like the little child. Sometimes it comes before we know, and you can stand back and see, look at the wisdom, the place that wisdom.
Isn't that a surprise when that happens? Somebody else had a question. Yes.
I have several questions that in midlife and after the humans to us, to our core health. And I wonder if you can relate that to the transcendental function.
The fourth function would be that which is least developed in us. Wouldn't it be? That which is, in a sense, unconscious. And that which is unconscious carries that great numinosity that Otto Rank talked about and Jung used his term. And we're often told to try to get in touch with our, I don't like inferior function, but the least developed function. And a person who begins to paint or to write, what emerges from the unknown? And we have another analyst here, Kate, Kate, would you like to say anything about this?
Well, I don't know. But I think possibly that when one is trying to develop this fourth function, the tension of the opposition is greater because it's so difficult to connect with that which is mostly unconscious. And so in holding the, at least my personal experience is that it's possible to connect to it briefly, then it's gone again. I mean, it's very troublesome for me. And so I suppose if one can learn to hold on longer to that, whatever that function is, I mean, for me it's thinking, so it's having an idea is dreadful experience to try to allow that to operate. But it's very, in a way, exciting after if it sometimes it's exciting. So I suppose that that's quite an oppositional tension, and I would presume that there would be quite a connection between the inferior or the fourth function and the transcendent function.
Thanks, Kate. Who else wants to add? Or yes.
Maybe I'm not knowledgeable enough, but I'm not totally getting this. When you talk about the transcendence, you mean it's the resolution of those two opposites, and is it corollary to the luminous? Is it aha? Is it I get it, or I don't need to worry about those opposites anymore, I'm on to something else?
I think it's an aha on the pathway. There's going to be more, but I think it's an aha. Can somebody else add to this? See, we said that as simply as we know how to say it, that the transcendent function is a psychological function that is the union of conscious and unconscious content. And go back to Jung's mountain climber. He got a certain piece of information of a possibility that might come about. He might step off into space. And it was in his unconscious. Well, consciously, he didn't do anything about it. So those two weren't joined in a sense, but they were because the information came up. And I don't think that we can't say that the transcendent function doesn't happen if we're not successful or hugely changed. Because he got the message and was brought up, but it wasn't integrated. So he goes mountain climbing and it comes to pass. Now, is this helping?
So by definition, you change your course of action. You change your behavior. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I think it's not that you change it, but it changes.
All right. Yes. Stand up, please.
No, I'm
sorry. Yeah. She's thinking. Yes, that's good. Hear this now.
I think essentially what happens is there are two absolutely oppositional things going on, and then always what we want to do is pick one. Because it's so hard that they both exist there. But what Jung has said is that if we can hold both possibilities long enough, out of that will come a third new thing. But it won't come by trying to make it come. It will only come on its own, and it won't come all the time. And often I think it comes by something that I like to call grace. So we never know. It's not something that the ego has any control over. Only that we can talk about it, that it seems to happen.
Is it ambivalence, anything like that? Ambivalence, yeah. Ambivalence, all conscious, as opposed to this business of the unconscious, wasn't conscious.
Well, I think out of the unconscious is where the third thing comes. Because we don't know what that third thing is, otherwise we...
How does it tie into Jung's idea that you never really solve anything, you just move on to new issues?
That's why I said it's an aha on the pathway. There are going to be more. You know the spiral that he talks about?
Is it sensual? Is it euphoria? Is it... I mean, I have my own experience with what I think you're talking about, but... does it come on like that? I mean, aha gives me a sense of pleasure, of sex, of sensual, of euphoria, if I want to make another one of these, so let's keep going. But obviously, I don't know, what do you think?
That's one way that it can manifest. I think we need to remember that the new place may not always be blissful and happy. See, that's what we want. And then we got Lucretia. David?
What you just said, I was thinking about Jonah and the whale. I think that's a good example. Sometimes it's the last thing in the world the ego wants. Mm-hmm. You know, the story of Jonah and the whale, Yahweh said, I want you to go do this. And Jonah said, no way. And he ran the other way.
When we hear of the dark night of the soul, and see, the ego doesn't want it, and that's the element of sacrifice that I talked about. I think Clarice, and then Lucretia, and then you.
I was just going to express a feeling that I'm aware of with the use of the word transcendent. Not that it's an unfortunate word to use, but there's something about a more common usage, understanding of that word that kind of conveys some kind of finality. And so there's kind of, when we use the word transcendent, there's kind of this pull to want a finality about it, but perhaps there isn't.
I think that's true, and that's that vertical. That's the, the finality. And remember, it's bridging across. Yeah, it's an unfortunate, maybe, term. Lucretia? That's nice, yes. What was your question?
Do you think that, like, Zen koan, those questions are like a sort of an impersonal study of the process of the transcendent function?
It certainly happens in there, doesn't it?
It kind of does create an impossible problem to resolve, and you have to kind of transcend the two opposites in some way.
And see, that would come out of the Zen tradition of religion, would it? Now, I'm not quite following you, because
you experience the process of the transcendent function in maybe an impersonal way. Not your personal problem, but...
Oh, okay. Yes, okay. But that has carryover, doesn't it, to our personal. And that's one of the ways that the collective made that collective vessel in the Zen tradition. Somebody else over here had a...
When I think about how do I know the transcendent functions operating, metaphor, kind of the scheme for me, is the metaphor of space. Like, it's creating space for something to be there that wasn't allowed to be there before. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of space or room for your experience. And of course, when we've been only on one side of it, you know, like one pole or an opposite, there isn't any room for what's on the other side. So when we allow that, then there's a sense of room to be.
And when you say allow, sometimes it simply erupts into that, doesn't it? And so then what do we do with it? And then if we allow it,
yes
indeed. That's a nice metaphor. You had a question.
Yes. Many of the things you said have triggered in mind, time speaking, the relationship of yin and yang and the movement of the energies, which are recursive energies, and also the resolution being the grounding or the centering or the meditative state which transcends, if you like, the energy movement between yin and yang. And also you mentioned the void, and it seems to me that relates to the wu qi or the eternal nothing from which we emanate. And you know, many of the things you've had on your charts that related to Eastern philosophy.
Oh, a great deal.
And this is my identification with it, and it seems to be quite clear to me that this is a recursive movement of energy and not just a one-way self-aggression.
No, it really isn't a one-way, is it? And if we had time to pursue this, it would just be so interesting. But thank you. Who haven't we had? You, and then you, and then maybe several more. Yes. Well, I'm watching the clock. You know, you've got buses to catch and so forth.
You were asking for, you know, how we might have an image of this. So I wanted to just contribute my image.
Yes.
And I felt it was Mark. You know, I kind of look at symptoms and I see a marker of loss at one at the beginning of it. And it's, for me, a transitional stage onto this transformation. And on either side, there's a new you, you know. And this period can take some time. It's not an easy period to find. If you were to look at the evidence of after and before, there would be a difference in how you would qualitatively want to.
There really would be, wouldn't there? Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's very little, and sometimes it's awesome.
I was wondering, this past weekend I was watching Lawrence Kasdan's film, The Grand Canyon, which I think has a marvelous illustration in there of Jung's idea of synchronicity through the characters we're having. I don't know if anybody's seen this. There's what I think is a good illustration. And then like a week or so ago, I saw The Phantom of the Opera, and I've heard that referred to as that artistic expression of the father complex. And I'm wondering if you could pull a pop illustration, a movie, a sitcom, something. If you can do a sitcom, you get double points.
I may need help here.
Something like, I mean, like, you know, the Force and the Star Wars movie, something that would illustrate the transcendent function at kind of a, I mean, I know that risks oversimplifying it, but...
Remember Yoda? That's not fair. It's so obvious. Okay. This man right here in striped shirt.
I think maybe that what happens in the Fisher King at the end, when he has to hold the tension of knowing that he has this psychotic atmosphere going on and the reality that's going on, and eventually those two come together, and he receives then his new life in a way. I'm talking about lovely. I don't know if that's the best an example there of him at the very end when he's lying on the grass there, and he has it both together. Exaggerated example.
It's a good reason for me to rent the movie again.
Yeah, that's a great good example.
In the current film The Crying Game, the whole movie seems to me an example of the unexpected arising.
The Crying Game he's talking about.
Yeah, there are all these conflicts, all these situations that you start coming up with your images of what will happen, and then this, I won't go and spoil it for anybody by saying what the resolutions are, but just things erupt and come into being that, you know, myself at least as audience couldn't imagine. And that seems to me to be an illustration.
I think that's an even better description.
Actually, I don't think there would be any stories if I think every plot. I'm thinking of the A Few Good Men. What was the one Scent of a Woman, where he's going to kill himself and then he doesn't. I really think that in all, that's why it threw me. I mean, it just flooded. I couldn't come up with anything for you. I don't think that there would be stories or plots if this wasn't continuously going on. All right, now I'm going to say one and then one more. Go ahead.
Could you put it in terms of communication terms as good cop, bad cop relationship?
Say that again?
Could you put it in communication context as good cop, bad cop, the interplay there?
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
No. I guess I'm getting dense.
The play that police have been interrogating.
Yes.
We have a good cop, a bad cop.
Yes.
Questioning a witness. The relationship between the two cops there seems to me to have those tensions in a communications context.
So, if the person being interrogated can hang in with both of them, something will happen.
Yeah.
the man in the white sweater, please, and then we're going home.
One of the things that I think a lot of these feelings come to me is when traveling in a new country or say in the mountains where you have a map and a destination, when you first begin your journey, there's so much uncertainty and there's so much indecision in terms of whether or not this is the right path you're on and whether or not it's going to fulfill all your expectations. And once you get to that first real destination, there's a sense of relief that you have gotten there. It is a wonderful spot. But pretty soon it's time.